Because we are not processing legislation. There's a lawyer that can help.
But here I must confess that I'm not familiar with a particular rule in this regard. If need be, we can do the necessary and get clarity. I would like to speak through my name. I would prefer that we maybe just quickly get the necessary clarity. I would say the other. Thank you.
Which is a procedural matter, because we will be joined by a member. We will come now. That's been asked to join us, and we will to make sure that we are able to continue our presentation there, first thing. The second thing is just to say that we would request Obama from the Department of Trade and Industry to summarize what you intended to present to us. Honourable Bauder, can I just check with you on the presentation that we made speaking to the WTO on the agency for how products like the bottom of the process. The essence of the legislation is that we are at the moment not at liberty as a country. For example, Arabian generics and US methods as a lower price and a high into a green. So we have now had a conversation in the World Trade Organization. As the Africa group, we want to take a proposal that liberates us from that position to the WTO. There will be a meeting in Kenya from the 15th to the 18th of December. And that's the agency of that is that's coming before us. So with your indulgence in particular, because I know the members of the ANC will be supportive of that member, but I promise that just trying to check if we can then have a very short presentation on that proposal, and then spend maybe about 45 minutes, let's say 20, 30 minutes for a presentation on the new investment goals, and then we have that conversation about that as well. I know what the first position is on the investment goal. I also know what the DA position is. I have access to our colleagues from the DA. The mission was with us the 9 morning, and it's allowed me to invest as well, so it's not that we don't want to be part of the. hope that they will still join us, because they were caucus in the city, in front of the Mark Stone. We have one apology that we received in writing, and we also have a letter, which is an apology from the Harlepper, who had to attend the community exhibition, reminding company his meeting with the community, and the community being there. She had to be there because it's the first meeting that I'm in this company. Our colleagues in the US put in this letter for me, that for the economic interest of people in the community, the mining industry happens to be a very important player and stakeholder. She personally apologized, but also made sure that she handled the apologies in front of the government. That said, honorable members, if there's nothing can be then handed to our colleagues to be glad. October, thank you very much for being your team. We are in your hands. It is now 10:20.
Okay.
So let's see if we can finish around everything by 10:20.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. And Honourable Members, we're going to try to really keep the presentation short. I'll just try to contextualize the issue that we get to the nub of the matter, and then call it along very quickly, I think. While I'm speaking, you'll see how we can shorten the presentation. Let me just say the question of bilateral investment treaties, which is a bilateral, by the name indicates, is between the two countries, right? Bilateral investment treaties that they have. We have made a move, and there's now one comprehensive piece of legislation, which will apply and give adequate protection to all investors. So in a sense, it will be a move away from the bilateral investment treaty. The reason this path has been adopted, and it's not only in South Africa, while we are pioneers, but there's an international consensus that there are fundamental weaknesses with bilateral investment treaties. The United States, the European Union, UNCTAD, everybody. What is called the first generation bilateral institutions, there's a general consensus that the model is flawed. Maybe there's lots of debate about what replaced it, but this. Now, what the fundamental problem with bilateral investment treaties is basically that there has been misuse, or if one can be more harsh to say there's been abuse of bilateral investment treaties. What has happened is that investors, because of the broad definition of expropriation and fair and equal treatment provisions, the drafting, what lots of multinationals have done is they have used that to challenge other issues, like public interest. So, for example, globally, a lot of the tobacco and alcohol regulations, for example, the packaging, where you must have plain packaging as in Australia. What companies have done in South America and in Australia, the multinationals have used bilateral investment treaties to challenge those legislations, to say, because you are doing that, that is affecting my profits. As a tobacco company, you are infringing on my profits, and therefore it's a form of expropriation. So they have abused the provision. So they have not used it because they have been expropriated. They have used it to challenge. In our case in South Africa, we've got two cases where we were challenged on it. The one was an Italian company, which when we did the mining, the NPRDA, as you know, they should use it, the empowerment provision in the mining legislation. An Italian company challenged us and said, now you're taking away my mining license in Northwest. I got this, and through the NPRDA, it's a form of expropriation. So they took it, and we had to spend millions of rand in trying to do that case. So as I said, it wasn't that we expropriated the Italian, it was a VE legislation, because they didn't want to go like the rest of the country with it. They used the banks to do that. The second one was a German investor, because he had private shares in the Reserve Bank. He wanted to say this is now, I must be paid out my shares. I need billions from the Reserve Bank. And if not, I'm going to take the South African government using German BIT under the challenge of South African government. He didn't even have the support of the German government. They were very embarrassed by actions and so on. But so what has happened is that because of this, but also it allowed a company to bypass domestic courts. Now because they've got the fit, they don't have to go in the normal court of law and argue their case. And then obviously the case will be dissolved because frivolous and vexation and so on. They can go directly to arbitration. And that's why we have to spend our time in Europe flying in lawyers, because they know we have to appear in front of this arbitration tribunal. So that's basically the case why everybody else says we can no longer use this mechanism. And that is why when our books that we had, because they've been in existence for almost 20 years, we had to make the decision, do we renew them or do we say they must terminate? So it wasn't a question that we had made on any agreements. We had to face a critical choice of renewal for another 10 years, or do we say we go for an alternative regime? So it was in that context that the South African cabinet agreed, let's not renew those ones. Even though, as I said, legally they've got what they call grandfather clauses, the protections carried on in any case for another 10 years. So we just decided to not renew them, so that at least in 10 years time expire, but it wouldn't be in 20 years time. So that is why it was decided the best thing to do is to, because South Africa already has a strong constitution, why don't we develop one piece of legislation which gives the full protection to investors, which satisfies their real interest, but we take away the ability to abuse it. So that is the basic, the context and the rationale for it, and so on. And I can ask Colette or maybe just to say the process we marked.
Thank you very much, Aditi. Thank you very much, in developing the bill, we went through a process of assessing the implication of the bill to South Africa. And there was a comprehensive research that was undertaken over 3 years. And what became clear out of that process is exactly what the DJ has already talked about. But most importantly, it became clear that there's no direct link in having this and the ability to attract investment. There's a number of studies, including by the OECD, that shows that the linkage is actually very ambiguous and sometimes non-existent. Even in South Africa's case, you are able to attract investment from countries you don't have seats. And the U.S. and Japan are key examples where we are able to attract investors without having any. And investors don't necessarily look at whether a country has it before they decide to invest. But maybe just to also take you through the key provisions of the deal. In developing the deal, as I said, we went through a thorough process of consultation, and we allowed the FEMA for any interested stakeholder to make a submission. And throughout that process, we have made the necessary revisions. And beyond that, we have also taken the bill through NELEC to ensure that we have thoroughly consulted. What we also did was to consult with the chamber, key chambers that will be affected, including the chamber. And they also had an additional opportunity through the parliamentary process to make further input. And through the parliamentary process, we started effectively in July. With the public consultation in September, any interested stakeholder was able to submit comments. And we again have revised the bill to ensure that we take into account all of those comments to the extent possible. But the key issue in developing the bill was to make sure that we provide protection to investors, but also ensure that it still maintains an open environment to FDI, because we recognize the importance of foreign direct investment to South Africa. But it's the game changer in this deal is that with this, what we used to do was to provide protection to foreign investors. With this deal, we are providing protection to investors, domestic as well as foreign investors, so they get equal treatment. We are leveling the playing field. So that's one of the important issues to note and remember. But also, what we are clarifying in the bill is the type of investment that will be protected. If you look at the definition of investment, we have opted for an enterprise-based approach to investment, which means that It must be an enterprise that is established in line with domestic law in South Africa, and it must commit resources of economic value over a reasonable period of time. And the aim of doing that is to ensure that you don't provide protection to speculative investment or portfolio investment. So that is also an in line with international practice. Because if you look at the U.S. one, they're also looking at similar issues. And in terms of the interpretation of the Act, we have ensured that everything that we do in terms of all of these provisions, we align to the South African Constitution. Already, the South African Constitution provides adequate protection to investment, including protection of property in terms of Article 25 of the Constitution, but also ensuring that investors have access to administrative justice in terms of Section 32, 33, 34 of the Constitution. So because the key issue with it is that if you look at compensation, it was going way beyond what is provided for in the Constitution. So what we are doing is to ensure that all the provisions that we provide in terms of ensuring that we put it into investment, it is in line with the South African Constitution. But beyond the protection that is provided by the Constitution, what we have done is to ensure that we provide also, or we include in the bill, these type provisions, which is in line with international customary law. Which again clarifies to investors that South Africa remains open to investment. And the concept that we have included is fair and administrative treatment. There was a lot of requests from the submissions that we include fair and equitable treatment. And the issue is that we have not included that because that is one of the provisions that has been abused by investors when they are suing government. What we have done is to ensure that we consent that government will ensure that there is administrative, legislative and judicial access in line with the Constitution and applicable legislation. So we guarantee the rights of investors in line with, as I've said, Section 32, 33 and 34 of the Constitution in terms of access to court, access to information, as well as administrative review. What we have also provided for in the bill under the provision on establishment is the post-establishment rights to investors, which means that the state will maintain the right to make regulations that govern the admission of investment. Because other countries do provide pre-establishment, which means that as an investor you get protected even higher to establish your investment. For us, what is key is to ensure that any investment that comes to South Africa, so that we are able to ensure that it is in line with a sustainable objective, but also is able to assist us in pursuing our developmental objectives, that it is established in line with domestic law in South Africa, which is why it is critical to get that goal. To clarify upfront to investors as to when will their investment enjoy the protection that is available under the bill. Also, what we have provided for, as I've said, beyond the protection that is available in the Constitution, we have included international concepts in terms of investment policymaking that are already known and that would give the comfort that they need to ensure that we are able to provide an open environment to investors. We have included the national treatment provision. What that means is that we are granting an investor the right to be treated no less favorably than a South African investor, as long as the investment is in like circumstances. There was a lot of discussion when we had the parliamentary process as to whether by including the like circumstances we are not including vague provisions that could be abused by government. Like circumstances is an internationally recognized term that is well understood in terms of the WTO. So any investor would know what we mean by like circumstances. But beyond that, what we've done is to include factors that can be considered if we are to determine whether the investment is in like circumstances, so that it provides the necessary certainty to investors and it is to apply. We have not included the most favored nation clause, because the DG has indicated we are providing protection to investors in South Africa as long as it is established in line with South African law, regardless of origin or nationality, because as you say, if it is a profession that is available to all investors, so it is not necessary for it to include the most favored nation clause. We have also provided physical deterrent of investment. As the details indicated, one of the cases that we had was by an investor that sued government because he had invested in a farm. The farm was vandalized, and he felt that we should have provided the necessary security, and he sued government using it. So to further clarify here, we have clarified that when it comes to security of investment, we mean physical security of investment, which means the police ensuring that they provide security, that they will provide to domestic investors as well, also depending on the availability of resources. But what you don't want is to create an expectation where investors feel that we need to ensure that we have police that are available to them all the time, things that we don't do for our citizens. So we want to make sure that we further clarify that provision in terms of the level of security that we are providing. Also included in the bill is legal protection of investment. And in this case, we have aligned with the Section 25 of the Constitution. So we have just amended Section 25 of the Constitution. There was a lot of calls in the discussion, especially in the Protocol Committee on Trade and Industry, for us to better explain what type of compensation will be provided. What we said is that Section 25 provides or guarantees that there won't be arbitrary deprivation of property, including expropriation of property. That is in Section 25. When it comes to expropriation, there's an expropriation bill that is specifically isn't related to expropriation. So it is not necessary in this bill to then have further elaboration as to how expropriation will be dealt. Because the challenge with you that is that you will have two bills that are dealing with the same issue that will create a confusion in the matter. So we have then decided to say for this bill we will just condemn certain things out of the Constitution. So that is what is provided for in the bill. With regards to the provision on the transfer of funds, which is again another provision that is available in this, what we have emphasized is that an investor may, in respect of their investment, repatriate funds, but this will be subject to taxation and other applications. Again, we are reaffirming the right of government to regulate, because if you don't emphasize all of those issues, what investors would expect is that they can take their funds anytime and anyhow. Most fundamentally, Mr. Chair, is to we have a clause here that confirms the right of government to regulate in the public interest. Because as the DG has indicated, initially these were really about protecting investors and their investment against expropriation. But increasingly, what investors are doing is to challenge laws that are put in place by government to regulate in the public interest. So it is very important for us to have that clause that emphasizes that we've got a right as the state to regulate in the public interest. So it then gives us an opportunity to come up with any legislation as long as it is in line with public interest and in line with the Constitution of South Africa. If I can further elaborate, in terms of the international challenge, this is based on a study that has been undertaken by UNCTAD. They've assessed, in terms of the cases that currently exist, what is being challenged. What is clear is that what is challenged are measures that are imposing or attempting to ensure that governments are able to collect tax, measures changing domestic fiscal policy, decisions regarding whether to grant development permits, bans on mining, environmental regulations, which is what happened in the case of Shemini, where a company that was involved challenged the German government in terms of a list that it had concluded when they wanted to change regulations which relate to nuclear energy after the Fukushima incident. So that company is now suing Germany for millions of dollars. And actually, it is that case that also changed the perception or the view of Germany with regard to that it is something that has been raising for a long time. It is a risk
2008 issue paper. So with that case now they get an appreciation of what we need. And with Australia, which is the case that the issue has indicated in Pacific, where they are trying to protect the public against smoking. A company is now challenging the Australian government because of that. If you look at the cost, Mr. Chair, what is also of concern is the cost that is related to defending this case. A study by the OECD has revealed that on average, to defend the cases cost around $8 million okay, each case. And in some cases, the cost can exceed $30 million. You can imagine what that means. But also, what is becoming clear is that there is an increase now in the amount awarded to investors if governments lose cases. In terms of a case that Russia lost, there was an award of $140 million. You can imagine what that would mean for a developing country or a developing country. For Peru, there was a claim of $50 million. Or Venezuela, $31 billion US dollars. So if you look at all of that, it was important that in developing this deal, we look at limiting the risk to South Africa in terms of these cases. And some of these cases, as the DG has indicated, are frivolous cases, and the government is to try and defend this case at a huge cost, taking resources away from service delivery to these cases. So the other issue is that we have provided for this business position. And we are saying, as the details indicated, it has to be through domestic costs. And we are also providing through this deal an alternative dispute resolution mechanism. We are providing an opportunity for mediation. So any investor that feels that the measure that is negatively impacting on them, they can come to the DTI and then we'll be able to mediate, to find an amicable solution. But they can also, they have a right to take it to court in line with our constitution. But if after exhausting the domestic legal process, they feel that they still agree, government may consent to take this decision. And it's important to emphasize that we have kept may, because what you don't want is that you have a case that has gone through a legal process and it's a frivolous case just because the investor wants to perceive the matter. We say the need that we consider the merits of the case at hand and consider whether it really is necessary for us to have a truthful application. As the details indicate that in the case of the investor that invested in the reserve bank, Germany was not in favor of the case. They understand the implications of taking huge sums of money from a reserve bank. So for that reason, we can find alternative mechanisms to a state-to-state process to find an amicable solution. But we are saying as well in the field that the consideration of whether to consider a state-to-state arbitration will be subject to a fair administrative process as set up in Section 2 of the deal. And I think that should really cover the key elements and the key provisions in the deal. Okay, just one issue, the issue related to whether this is aligned or so, and the honourable members would have had this discussion as to whether the deal is aligned to the SADC protocol. We can indicate, Mr. Chair, that South Africa is a member of SADC, and as a member of SADC, we are actively involved in the SADC processes that ensure that we learn from global development and we ensure that any protocol or agreements that we have at a regional level take into account those developments. There is already a standard model that has been approved by the standard structure that is aligned to this. In addition, we are in the process that is advanced because at the technical level discussions have been concluded. To review the finance and investment protocol because it exposes the countries that have signed that protocol to a risk of being sued by investors because it was concluded in line with the first generation. So the process is in place to review that protocol. As I said, it has been reviewed. It is just waiting for approval. So It is therefore not correct to say this deal will contradict the Tata's finance and investment protocol. But also what is important is that the Tata's finance and investment protocol does not prohibit any member, including corrupted from developing its own relationship. We are still bound by the financial and investment protocol at an international level, but it doesn't stop us from developing our own legislation at the same time. I thought we should also emphasize that this became one of the issues of the day with regard to this. Thank you, Mr.
Just to conclude on what Jay is that I was taken us through the book, just to reassure you about the issue of the FDI, foreign direct investment, because of course one of the criticisms that was made was that if we cancel these DITs, we are going to scare away foreign investors. That was the sort of big story. I think we can just confirm that as you know, we cancelled the or did not renew the VIP with Germany. 2 weeks ago, the minister was there where the CEO of BMW launched the 6 billion investment. The reason it's significant is because it is not only the biggest investment by BMW, but it's the biggest investment ever in the automotive industry. And this is after the cancellation of the bids. BMW is fully aware of everything. They decided to go ahead with that investment, and what is really interesting is because when the CEO Tim Abbott was addressing the media at the launch 2 weeks ago in Rosslyn, they asked him, well, how come this investment is being made in South Africa, given that there are so many strikes here, given South Africa's problems and so on. And he then explained that they're going to be building, as you know, that plant built the 3C, they're going to now build the SUVs, the X3, and it's going to be the only other plant besides, they only have one other plant in the world, which is the US. They decided on Rosslyn, because Rosslyn has been, as you know, they won the JD Power Award, which was that Rosslyn is the most competitive plant in the entire BMW stadium, all BMW's plant. So it has the least, it has the highest quality, it has the lowest rejects, and so on. So they decided for South Africa for that reason. It's the most competitive plant. As you know, we've also had the 5.4 by Mercedes-Benz. We've had, with the UK, we've had Unilever opening four brand new plants. The Magnum ice creams we all enjoy. They opened that factory about a month ago in Gauteng as well. So, as Kolewa said, there's no correlation between that. And the reason is that we are fortunate to have a country where property rights is protected in your constitution, not even in just in law. And that, as I said, that has given adequate protection to those investors. I think I should just reassure the committee that the FDI is proceeding actually very well.
Thank you very much. Can I request that what we do is to finish the one. Let's finish the promotion and protection of the investment world and then go to the house later. We do have our legal minds from Parliament here with us.
Okay.
And we see that we have quite a number of colleagues from the DGI as well. So members, you are free to raise any aspect of the promotion and protection of investment law or FDI as you have the need to do it. It is open. Do you want to give out a feedback quickly on the...
It's entirely up to you, papers and textbooks.
Please do that now, just so that we know.
This is, of course, the roots of the ECLT. It is in the rule is 201 papers dealing with committee reports in respect of section 75 code that has been referred to this honorable committee. I'm not going to read all of it, but here at the operative part chairperson, it is in subgroup 4. The bill is passed by the council, in this case represented, of course, by this honorable committee. If the bill and any amendments are agreed to by the council in terms of section 75(2),
philosophical juices. Let us section 75.2, if I could very briefly maybe read part of the text. When the NCLT votes on a question in terms of the section, section 65 does not apply, so we don't need to go there instead. And then we go to subparagraph C. The question is decided by a majority of the votes cast. But if there is an equal number of votes on each side of the question, the delegate presiding, the opposition chair, has cast a deciding vote. And then there is an explicit provision dealing with quorum. Here it is. Each delegate in the provincial delegation has one vote, and then the next, at least one third of the delegates must be present before the vote can be taken. So quorum is the third chairperson, a simple majority on the vote, with you having a decisive. Thanks for the opportunity.
A third of the members or a third of the public?
I beg your pardon, sir.
The one third. Is it one third of provinces or one third of the members?
Of the members.
One third of the members. We say the votes. Okay, thank you very much. Colleagues, let's engage with the presentation.
Can we start with a lot of technical questions?
Anything that you want to raise, please. I'm going to apply the rule, 30 minutes for your questions. You can raise as many as you want within the 30 minutes.
I also think they just have questions. I have more questions.
But then we will only allow one round with your missions, members. We only allow one round.
Okay.
Let everyone go in together, and then for Leva, thanks very much for the presentation. Honorable Ntebe is from Northwest. We can expect a minority to come in. Honorable Bauda is from Pumalanga, so we can expect a coal mine to come in. Let's have the two of them then answer that, and then the two members have questions.
Well, I think right from the top, we must appreciate the best life in this country has done a great deal of work. And we applaud them for making a forward line. But this is, and I hear you talking about great work. As a layman, probably I understand the meaning that you need to lay to protect those who are involved at that time of the education from whatever was that meant, whatever the deal was. In this case, you are then saying the issue, because of the grandfather involved, this will in any other to continue for the next 10 years. However, this deal will keep it to exist beyond 10 years, to increase it to 20 years. Does it take away the competitive advantage from the internet, from the domestic market, that we want to also give them space to be able to? If not, what is it that we are offering as a contingency to our own domestic environment? I could give an example. We have many views, but in so many ways, there's always a protection from one country to the other in terms of their own domestic environment. In this case, is there anything that like that? I've seen how every corner of the country has welcomed the investment by the NRC. I think it's a great thing. I think we are also speaking about how do we want to elevate objectives of the NRC in terms of our skills and information. Are there any aspects like speaking to that as part of the community and including to enhance our ability as a country to also go into that change? And I think before I delay you, the last one is if we are going to have the same sort of, before the last one, we are leveling the playing ground. If we are going to do that, what does that mean to the many domestic investors in our country?
Thank you.
Thank you, for how long they will still be the remaining assets for the next 10 years is still a gray area. How adequate we recover during that period to ensure that we do not have the types of pains that have arisen in other countries like Venezuela and even Germany. The other issue that I'm not sure, I've seen some attempts in the road to control. We talk here mostly about the protection of the investor. On the blue chain, investment without moral conscience, investments without social justice, you know, these are not investments that, at the end of the day are going to be really beneficial to the long-term best interest of the country. I understand that there was some mention about the investors seeking police protection, police security, whatever. The best security we can provide for the investor is to ensure that we have stable society. And the best way to have a stable society is to ensure that we have we are being fair to our own people back home. If we are fair to the society, then we can have a stable society. And that is the best platform for investment. I'm a firm believer that we will always have investments in this country. I think once, Dindi, you mentioned yourself that we are one of the countries with amongst the richest resources in the world. That is in itself an indication for investment. And if we provide a stable society, a stable socio-economic system in the country, that is enough to invite these investors, and we should need to convince them. I'm not sure if this is adequate coverage, but please help me. I've seen something here about 2.9, the actual regulation and so on, but I don't know if we have something in detail and whether we are covering our family well enough in this regard.
Thank you very much.
I know that these are two questions from this side, and not two. And the three from the museum. Can we get the responses from the design?
In terms of the issue around the grandfathering of the survival clauses, what we have indicated in the bill, because we have also to observe the specifications that we have, there is a transitional clause, and that is in the bill, that recognizes that we do have the bids that are either in place or the bids that have been terminated, and that we still have those survival clauses. And the survival clauses range from 10 years, sometimes 15 years. And so the term and the protection that is available within those bilateral investment treaties will still continue. Of course, the deed is that the risk would have been that if you don't terminate, then they would continue for a further period. But what that means is that they will continue and there will be, the terms will still be in place, but what we are saying is that there won't be new bilateral investments that we are going to conclude in future. Investment protection will be provided for through this. So there will be coexistence for a period of time until those survival clauses basically come to an end. And it's all to observe the obligations that we had in terms of product. And the other question was whether we are enhancing through this bill our ability to implement the NDP and skills development. What we are saying is that by preserving the right of government to regulate in the public sector, we are saying that we're giving government quality space to regulate in terms of all the key issues that we need to regulate for in order to drive our socio-economic transformation agenda as provided for in the key policy instruments of government as well as the South African Constitution.
So through that provision, we are therefore reaffirming the right, so that if we have to come up with either policies or measures that want to promote either SME development, we have that right without anyone challenging us in terms of those. So it is one of the pieces of legislation that is going to assist us to then be able to achieve our social economic transformation agenda, because it suggests the right of government residents in their public interest. In terms of leveling the playing field, what we are saying is that in the past disaster, we used to provide protection only to international investors. Now we are saying we are going to provide protection to all investors, regardless of where they are coming from. So in a way, we are therefore leveling the playing field. And but the issue is that in terms of emerging investors, we have various instruments through which we ensure that we are able to facilitate and promote investment. And one of those is that we are in the DTI also establishing an investment clearing house that will ensure that we are able to promote and also facilitate investment. And there are various mechanisms through which we also support emerging investors. We are now just in the cabinet that just approved the Black Investors incentive program. So those are some of the initiatives that are available to government and government is putting in place to ensure that we are able to support emerging investors. And in terms of the risk due to the survival clauses on our voucher, as I said, the risk really comes in if there is going to be unfounded expropriation. As the DG has said many times, as government, we are a responsible democratic government. We observe the rights that are available to everyone in the constitution, including investors. But of course, because of the survival clauses and the terms that are available in those, there is still some risk that can exist, which is why we are saying it's important and urgent that as South Africa we develop this legislation that will govern the protection of investment going forward, which is why it is also critical that through this we provide the necessary legal setting to how investment is going to be protected going forward and what type of investment will be protected going forward. And we agree with the Honourable Bowser that investment policy should be part of the broader strategy of government, which means that it must assist us to achieve, as I said, the objectives that we set ourselves in the country in terms of the key policy instruments of government. Of course, the number I get a sense from your question that you're also saying we should be putting obligations to investors. Which is why in this deal we are saying that we are going to protect investment that complies with domestic laws of the country. And the domestic laws are interesting. Whether you talk about human rights, you talk about labor rights, all of those, any investment that will be protected has to comply and be established in line with the domestic laws of South Africa.
I think just to conclude on that issue, I think the issue between domestic and foreign investors, I think, I don't know, as Koroma mentioned, we have a range of other policies. I think the most important one is the industrialization policy. Currently, with an unemployment rate of 25%, the only way we're going to solve the unemployment problem is we have to, when we talk about growth, we mean gross domestic production. We must expand domestic production. That's the only way you can solve the unemployment problem. The foreign investor plays a critical role. Because, as explained with the BMW, 60% of our auto export goes into the international market. Now, what the foreign investor brings is critically access to global market. So by producing the BMWs in South Africa, we are able to use the market of BMW across the world, and then with others. And also, they bring the latest technology. And that is why they are net benefit
to the country. The fact that they're foreign is not the major issue, because they bring up the global market, which allows us to expand the production. We do simultaneously, in terms of our iPad, we do promote local champions. So if you take Bell Equipment, AeroSuit, in the aerospace industry, Transit Rail, and so on, we are also building on local capabilities to produce. Now we're producing drones in Danel, we're producing locomotives in South Africa under Transnet, we're producing ships again, and so on. So we are redeveloping our own domestic capabilities. And then, so I think the key to this we'll try to do is just try to ensure that we create the right balance between the domestic and the foreign.
Thank you very much. You have been so thorough in that great presentation that you've done that even if you rest it up, you would cover this issue. Maybe this assertion that stood just to be on this. Thanks so much. Can we then move to the next presentation? Please?
Yes, please.
I'm just reminded by the people that move to think that we need to finish off the processing of this promotion and special competition. Do you have the thing you said it was the colleagues, we have agreed that we will report to the NCOP on this bill on Wednesday. And I'm now seeking your permission that this and that Committee on Trade and International Relations that we consider the subject of the Protection of Investment Bill, referred to it and classified by the Joint Chamber Mechanism, as a Section 75 bill. The report that we have agreed to present the bill to the NCOP. Any objections, correct?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll try to be very brief to talk about the proposal to amend the TRIP agreement to bring into place flexibility for public health. The agreement on track-related aspects of intellectual property rights as the TRIP agreement. It's an international agreement that is administered by the WTO, World Trade Organization. TRIPS is the most comprehensive international agreement that deals with intellectual property rights. And it introduced for the first time intellectual property law into the international trading system. South Africa is a signature of TRIPS because we are also a member of the WTO and then this is undertaking in the WTO in terms of to accept all of the agreements that fall under the WTO. If you look at the TRIPS agreement as it stands currently, there's already flexibility in the agreement that allows, for example, compulsory licensing. So where a country can grant a compulsory license to a manufacturer in that country to produce a patented product without the permission of the patent holder in a public health crisis situation. But that is only under certain circumstances that could to also protect rights of the patent holder, and it is only for domestic use. It must be mostly for domestic use. So the problem with that is that many developing countries do not have the capability of producing medicine for themselves. So they are never able to use resistance if they are not producing themselves. So what happened is the Africa Group made a proposal in the WTO that the threat agreement needs to be reviewed. And we need to make provisions specifically for additional flexibility to address the public health issues and practices that exist in countries. So in 2001,
at the Ministerial Council meeting in Java, they was a decision that was first, initially when this came up before the 2001 meeting, a lot of the developed countries rejected the proposals for additional flexibility because they think that it's very important that we keep protecting the intellectual property rights of the of companies and the research and development that I put into developing these medicines. But there was then a question by the member states of the WTO that the high prices of medicines put by patent protection is causing problems in developing countries in dealing with issues like HIV, AIDS and malaria and other health crises, but especially in the developing countries where this incites abortion. So in the 2001 declaration, at the Ministerial Council meeting in Doha, the ministers agreed on a declaration on TRIPS agreement and public health. And this declaration basically recognized the gravity of the public health problems in affecting many developing and developed countries, especially those relating to HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis and so forth. It recognized that intellectual property protection is important for the development of new medicines, and it recognized as well the concerns about the effect of prices of these medicines for developing countries and adequately being able to address some of these issues in their countries. It also recognized that the TRIPS agreement does not and should not prevent members from taking measures to protect public health. And it reaffirms that TRIPS can and should be interpreted and implemented in a manner that supports the members' right to protect public health and in particular to promote access to medicine for all. Importantly, it clarifies that a public health crisis can represent a national emergency and other circumstances of extreme urgency, and that this can be either a short-term problem or a long-term problem. And it places the burden on a complaining member. So if a member complains that another country is infringing on patient rights, it places the burden on that complaining member to prove that the emergency or urgency does not exist. So the burden of proof changes. And it also makes it easier for developing countries to adopt measures necessary to ensure access to healthcare without the fear of being dragged into legal battles about whether you adhere to the patent protection as it out in steps or not. The declaration gives members more flexibility in utilizing the parallel import mechanism and in granting of compulsory licenses. It also states importantly that members should determine through their own national legislation the grounds upon which licenses are to be granted for compulsory licenses. And also that members can decide for themselves what constitutes a national public health emergency. It also does not limit the diseases for which this compulsory licensing can be used depending on the circumstances in your country. So in 2003 at the Ministerial Council meeting in the WTO, there was an agreement on a waiver until a permanent solution was found. And in 2005 at the Ministerial Council meeting, there was a decision and an adoption of a protocol amending the TRIPS agreement to allow for this additional flexibility. So basically what this additional flexibility will allow, as I said in the beginning, currently you can issue a compulsory license, but only for production of this patented product and certain circumstances in the health crisis for your own domestic market. And if there may be a bit left over, you can export it. This additional flexibility now allows countries to issue compulsory licenses to produce a product for export. So you would be able to produce the patent and product or a generic of a patented medicine to export to another developing country that is having a health crisis and that needs to access these medicines at a cheap price. The protocol was open for patients until 2000, December 2007, but because not enough members at that time really accepted the protocol, the protocol was open for a further period for acceptance. Two-thirds of the WTO members need to accept the protocol as amendments for the protocol to enter into force. Currently, 86 countries have submitted the acceptance documentation to the WTO, and another 21 is needed for this protocol to come into operation. So I believe the two-thirds. It's therefore, especially since South Africa was the driving force as far as the African group and getting these capabilities, it's very important for us to go through the process and to ratify the agreement so that we can also submit our acceptance of the amendment to the WTO and get nearer to this point of the acceptability that's provided in the amendment protocol to come into operation. There is in December, from 15 to 18 December, there will be a Ministerial Council meeting of the WTO in Nairobi. And one of the key outcomes is the first time the Ministerial Council meeting will be held in Africa. And one of the key outcomes that has been targeted is for us to see if it's not possible to ask the Ministerial Council meeting for this protocol to come into effect. It's very important to take people for developing countries and countries in Africa to have these sort of capabilities. If you just look at the constitution in terms of Article 27.1, it says that everyone has the right to have access to healthcare services, including reproductive health care. And 27.2 states that the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve the objective realization of each of these rights. So if you look at Section 27 of the Constitution, that is a further emphasis on the government to put in place any measures, including these sort of measures that in the protocol on the flexibility to access cheaper medicine to assist assist us in also doing that the health care that we are obliged to in terms of the constitution.
Thank you very much. If you will look at the presentation, then we have two colleagues here.
I'm not saying that we have the correctness.
Thank you very much. We will throw it open for questions if there are any. Let me just kick off by asking, why is this only coming to us now? What was the reason for this? Let's take a few more.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, she just explores the whole issue of behind the patent is why they exist and what is the reason for it. Just to elaborate a little bit on that, give us a better understanding of what that is. So, we should not, there's an opportunity here, Chairperson, for South Africa. We should not only look at this as an opening, perhaps the import thing.
Yeah.
We should look at the FDS to establish or develop a type of a pharmaceutical highway. Something like what they've got in India. You follow.
Yes.
So that we can export from here because there are not many countries in sub-Saharan Africa that are in this position that we are in. It will assist us in creating jobs in a very, very big way because it's a tremendous opportunity for us. The other one that we should be, I don't know where we're going to structure, maybe the council will look at the quality of the import that will be coming in. And I'm thinking especially of the fact that we are so open and readily agreeable on importing drugs, but there are certain in South Africa when we have doctors that qualify from overseas we have any six names to blame before they can actually start practicing. I'm not saying that it should not be so. So we should also have some magic in place to ensure that. But I'm sure that will be covered by the department of health.
Just before I take the next hand to set up, when we listen to Minister Polynesia Bailey talking to us about South Africa's intervention on the Ebola crisis, on the entire continent, particularly our intervention in the area of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and we look at this particular legislation, we could have been in big trouble because we were largely dependent on doctrines without borders.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened is that we opened a beautiful lab in Pretoria where we are beginning to also do our research on NGOs. We have to return to the using that. Not at
the bottom of the fun.
That we can use to fight the Ebola virus. And the vaccines. Not that we've advanced with it, but in the manufacturing of the clothing and pens and gloves and things like that, there's wonderful opportunity for us. Now we need to compete against the superpowers. And therefore, this one then also helps in the LBCs to be able to deal with that. That's the one. The second is about that issue with Hawking. I thought of this place that we visited, I won't mention its name, the pharmaceutical company in the that exports.
Mm-hmm.
And the MD came all the way from Joburg to meet with us. I'm not sure where, I think we're there with us. It was just excellent to hear about the capacity and training that they did in there. I looked at the photos of the people that they have on there. And the chief laboratory scientist was a young black man. And therefore, I mean, the same point that has been made earlier on by about does this really benefit us? And you correctly point out that I'm very good at this. At the moment, you look at our HIV rates and we help them on the countries who have big pharmaceutical companies, which are there in the region, where we are in the world, the country that's making the biggest breakthrough in terms of providing medication for people living with HIV rates. And it's a heavy burden on the business. So if we could get to track the same healing ability at the government and on the issues. Let's see if there's any more questions on the other. It looks like you have something.
No, I don't have questions. I have anything to tell you to my friend away. I don't know how. I have a feeling that there's only one country that needs to watch it at once. It needs to be something to happen. This is something that is urgent. Affected a lot of investment into our country and everybody was assuming that Africa is just one cheap collective society. And this is one thing that we really have to do. Recently DGU was starting the difficulty of achieving how gas generated and how it's not in the energy. And part of which is how do we then make it happen and how do we make it happen and how do we make it happen. So as a young lady who lost hearing because TV was just too much, showing the process of trying to save life, the hearing was affected. And that's something that I think.
Maybe to then make it a bit fair to raise the question how possible it would be for the 22 countries to be ready to the community of meeting, having two-thirds majority to be able to process. Can we end with those, with that question?
Yes.
Please.
Maybe I can start with Mr. Chen. You asked the question as to why it has taken us so long to ask the class. Immediately after we had fought so hard for this flexibility, there was a lot of outcry from civil society, especially PAC. Now they are coming under the banner of the Fix the Picture Coalition. Even though this is a good flexibility, and they acknowledge that this is a flexibility that we need as developing countries as well as developed countries. But their concern was around the procedures that it can be followed, that they are cumbersome and they make it difficult for developing countries to use this flexibility. So we got a lot of resistance from them in terms of us ratifying this instrument. So over the years we have been engaging with them to try and convince them that, you know, it is difficult to change the system and your outcome. That it is important that we ratify, we part of the system and then use our influence to then see how we can improve the procedures to ensure that it is easier for developing countries to use this flexibility. So we again met with them, the last meeting that we had with them, Honorable Chair was last week. And we got full end of season support from them to say it is important that South Africa ratifies, and they understand the importance of ratifying as quickly as possible, given that for this flexibility to come into force, we need to ensure that there is ratification by Cuba. Maybe just to also respond to the Honorable Lieutenant President, your question here is, so how possible is it to get a 31 member? The DG of the WTO has written to all the WTO members to indicate that the deadline is 31 December for the end of this flexibility, that it is important that all the member states that are still to ratify to ratify, which is why we've seen an increase now to 81. Otherwise, before it was about 40. So there's an increase in international countries that are ratifying. But of course, we're also working through the regional as well as continental structures to ensure that we encourage the regional economies to also emphasize that they must ratify given the importance of this instrument to developing countries. The last meeting that we attended was the CMT Committee of Minister of Trade in Sadat, and this issue was also raised there. So we hope that through all of those interventions, the requisite number would be achieved.
My aim is to ask you to that the principle is open until the 31st December this year for acceptance. But in case we do not meet that 2/3 at the Assam Ministerial Council meeting, there is a decision group that will be put before the ministers begin to expand the PA to another 3 years. But we hope that will not be necessary, but there is a backup for Queensland to enable us to have an additional time period if needed to bring the flexibility and the amendment into full operation. And in terms of the question you asked about why patents, why do we need patents? Of course there is a cost of patents, as you say, that for example for medicine, for any product really, it increases the cost. It makes it very difficult in some instances to access medicine at the same prices, because the company that has produced this product and got the price, they can get the price. But unfortunately, we don't need guidance. Because that encourages countries or companies to actually take out that money and do the research and development to find the drugs and the different uses that we can have for the drug. It does cost a lot of money. So you need to have some sort of encouragement for these companies to go through these processes, to spend money, sometimes it takes years. It's how you balance it. So how do you balance protecting and giving them some advantage to having spending all of this money, but also the needs of countries to be able to access and people to access that those drugs at a reasonable cost. So, and that's what we're trying to do here now in the trip. We recognize the rights that you have to a patient, but how do you use access also where it is needed. So I think that the question, as Serena said, that was asked by civil society is, are we getting enough flexibility now for countries to be able to access this as a right? There is, we can use the system candidate. I mean, I think we all agree to that. And the creating inside being, of course, even for the technology motivator. Then I think that you are very correct in the issue that was raised, that this is not only an opportunity for us to import, not at all, this is also an opportunity for us to export. That is one of the big problems, because even if a developing country had the capability of manufacturing these drugs, it was not cost effective in many instances, because it could only do it for the domestic industry. So, there was not enough people, not enough needs for it, so you could not really cover the cost. So now there would be an opportunity for developing countries, including South Africa, and this is one of the sectors in the IPAC, that is a priority sector, for us to develop some of these products under a compulsory license and then be able to be exported to another country that is having a public health crisis in terms of tuberculosis or what it may be. So there's a few benefits to this. Public health benefit, that's the first, of course, the main benefit, but also that we will be able to increase our industrial capacity by implementing this system.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the window and seeing them saying it's fine. Do we need to use that one? We'll present the both of them once they can. I don't know how that's just going to work. But let me present to you the report of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations on the World Trade Organization SWT's decision on the implementation of paragraph 6 of the Doha Declaration on trade-related excess of intellectual property rights of the Crux Agreement in public health. Dated to report on November 15, with the Select Committee having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the World Trade Organization's decision on the implementation of paragraph 6 on the trade aspect of intellectual property rights in public health, requesting penalty in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution. Recommend that the Council approve the same agreement. No, by reading it, they are indicating this. If I look at the input that they've been given,
I'm not just not
on the
yeah.
So we agree.
I made a mistake just a while ago in respect of the cause that you require when it comes to decision making on Section 75. So I want to apologize for that. It's clearly there. When a question is to be decided in terms of Section 75 of the Constitution, the question may be decided only if a majority of the permanent members of the committee is present. Please accept my apology. I have to apologize many times. This committee is unfortunate. I'm sure that something is like the address and correction.
Majority of the permanent
members. Of the permanent members. Thank you.
A good lawyer said for that. I
think I'm trying to restore the majority. You've seen this with a problem. Yeah, you're
right. There are 10 permanent members.
colleague from Bajibuna Sadhguru Mahan on the member of this committee. So our disadvantage is coming to our advantage. Myself, Mchimunye, Nrita, Vauda, Teve, Kale, Mukwena, Lom, who's this one doing? No, I don't even know that.
The majority member, is it provincial or is it actually form body? And I want to let the layman give it to the province president in the case of the select committee. But we still need to get a regular advice on that.
Because that was my understanding as well. The majority, you know, by any because the two of you are from the same crop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's the interpretation.
It's permanent member.
It's a permanent member. It doesn't say provincial candidate. It's permanent member.
The majority of permanent members of the committee.
Which is that in the rules?
That is rule. That's part 6 of the rules, dealing specifically with proceedings in the select committee, and it's rule 154, dealing with composition, quorum, and voting. I don't think we will get any guidance beyond this provided for specifically in here, Chairperson. But the terminology is clear.
Thank you very much to the colleagues from DDI. Thank you for that legal advice. And thank you for taking the
team.
We have a scribe. I know you are not extraordinary well recorded. Thank you to the honorable members for your advice. Yes. We have the one then we go to the generic register.
Yes, thank you.
The meeting is adjourned. I'm inviting you for lunch on the ground. at my apartment.
What time?
I wish I could. Are we meeting?
Yeah.
Yes,
we are.
Why are
we meeting?
The minister wants to be there, but
Thank you.